This holiday season, have yourself the perfect little gift to give. Austin Christmas. Ten classic Christmas songs performed by some of Austin's finest artists. Featuring Michael Kincaid, Tamika Jones, Ty Austin, T-Double, Clyde and Clem's Whiskey Business, and more.
Come our way, ho, 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 cherry nose, cap on head, suit that's red, special night, beer that's white.
Available online now at same-sky.com.
Santa Claus is coming.
That's same-sky.com. Also available in stores and on iTunes. Austin Christmas.
How are you? I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. It's the holidays. You might be listening to this while you're driving to go see your family somewhere or going to see somebody somewhere. Whoever you're going to see, maybe you're dreading it. You're sitting there fucking like, why am I doing this? Why am I going to go see these people? They drive me crazy. Or maybe you're like really excited. I'm pretty excited. I'm going to go spend a few days with my family and I'm excited about it. So I won't be listening to this podcast when I'm driving. I might be listening to another one. And I'll be excited. And I'll be with my cousin Megan, who's my traveling partner in the holidays. We go places together. And then we celebrate when we get there. Anyway, so I wish everybody a very Merry Christmas. I think we're going to put out episode 131 on Christmas Eve in the morning. So that way, if you're driving that day, you have another podcast to listen to. You know what I mean? So I'm almost done. I'm three quarters done is what I'm trying to say. With my Christmas shopping, I'm almost done. I'm getting close. I've got a couple more gifts I got to get, and I went out today to try and do some, and I just failed miserably. I got caught in traffic, and that always makes me anxious, and then I totally fucked up and wrote down on the calendar that I was doing this interview that I had today I thought I was doing it at 3, but I was doing it at 1. And so anyway, I had to reschedule to tomorrow. And then I just came home in failure, total failure. I don't know why the holidays have that sort of feeling, like I'm failing at Christmas. I'm not doing this right. Like, oh, fucking Christmas is just, it's one step ahead of me. And I'm behind, and I'm going to lose Christmas. I'm going to lose at Christmas. It's going to be like Christmas 1, Johnny 0. And that's going to be the score. If I can't find this fucking present. If I can't find the right cutting block with a naked lady on it and her innards exposed for crying out loud. Christmas. Stress time. My guest today. He's an amazing musician. He's been a bass player for a lot of years. He also has become a front man and singer-songwriter. His name is Ted Russell Camp. He lives in L.A. He was here a few weeks ago playing some shows in Austin. And I had some friends hook me up with him. And my friend Robin, she hooked me up with him. And she came down and we got to sit down and talk. I got to talk to him. He's played with Shooter Jennings and Wilson Phillips and all kinds of people. And he's been out doing shows and he tours in Europe and America, and he's going to talk all about it. He's a really interesting guy. He's a really nice guy. Had a great time talking to him. So I guess without further ado, here's my friend, Ted Russell Camp. Let's get down.
Storm tries to spin you around.
You don't ever listen to the records?
Yeah.
What do you mean? You don't ever listen to your records?
No, I do. Of course, I listen to a lot when I'm doing them. Occasionally, I listen to them when I'm driving around. Like, I live in Los Angeles, and so a lot of the times when I tour, I fly out wherever I'm going.
Okay.
And I'll do some shows solo, and then when I can afford it, or when the gig calls for it, I bring in a band.
Okay.
So I...
How big of a band? Because that's a pretty big sound.
That is a pretty big sound. There are a decent amount of overdubs on a song like that.
Yeah.
But usually I'll play with sometimes a power trio, sometimes a four-piece, sometimes a five-piece. Like I played at Green Hall the other day.
Yeah.
And we had two guitars, bass, and drums. A buddy of mine from Fort Worth, Josh Davis, played guitar. Michael O'Connor, who lives down kind of in the Austin area, played guitar too. Mm-hmm. And then we brought in John Chipman to play drums.
I know John Chipman.
So, oh yeah, he's wonderful.
Yeah.
So sometimes when we're driving around from gig to gig and I want to teach the guys a new tune, or there's something that they kind of were winging, like they're all very good musicians, but of course they're not going to necessarily know the music as intimately as I will. So I'll say, oh, let's listen to this one, and there's this guitar thing. Or, hey, let's break it down here.
Right, right.
Of course I listen to my records sometimes, but...
You don't jam them, though, after you make them. You don't like, oh, yeah, I'm on my way to the beach.
Right, let's rock out to my last record. No, I usually don't do that. Like when my mom is visiting,
right,
we'll drive around listening to my music because it makes her feel so good. But it's nice to hear.
Sounds good.
Just a few seconds, I've been like, wow. I remember all those little details and the things I put into it and the photographic recollections of like who I was in the studio with and what it felt like.
Yeah.
And oh yeah, I remember I did that guitar overdub in a hotel room on my Line 6 thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like hearing that stuff.
So that's from Night Owl. That's from your new album.
Night Owl is coming out
in January.
Month.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was California Wildflower was a song for my last record, Get Back to the Land.
Okay.
Which is actually only about a year and a half old.
So you're a pretty prolific guy.
I try to keep moving.
Yeah.
Stay inspired.
You also can get to a chorus before 50 seconds.
Yes.
Fucking, that's old school.
Don't Ted, bore us.
Ted Russell Camp. That's your name, Ted Russell Camp.
You got it.
And you're a bass player / like as a sideman and plus songwriter, frontman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you still doing some sideman stuff? You get calls?
Yeah, I do. It's interesting. I love, actually, most of my professional career has been just playing bass in people's bands.
Yeah.
That kind of evolved into me getting more serious about songwriting and writing songs with the people I'm working with, producing a little bit as well.
Yeah. Did you work with Robin Wiley, who's sitting next to you?
I have. Robin and I are good friends.
Yeah.
Robin is from Texas, and she lived in L.A. for a while, which is where we met.
Okay.
And so I used to play in Robin's band, and she started playing in my band with me. We've written a bunch of tunes together.
Good.
And so now every time I come back to Texas, Robin will sit in and we'll hang out as much as we can.
Yeah. So where are you from originally? What's your
New York
score? Yeah.
I'm from Westchester. Okay. Which is suburbs just north of New York.
Yeah, I was
City.
Just there.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Where were you?
I was at I can't remember the name of it, but I was at a place where George and Barbara Bush got married.
All right.
And had their, had their reception.
Okay.
In this country club. And
right
it was
on.
These, a comedy writer and Andy Kindler's niece were getting married.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. Zach Galifianakis was a groomsman. It was insane. He played drums with our band.
Oh, that's really cool.
Nuts.
Right on.
So, so I was just there. That's it. So your music doesn't really sound like a guy from Westchester.
No.
So what was that? Were you like a country club kid or like a...
Not really country club kid. I was definitely on the swim team.
Yeah.
As a kid.
I was on the swim team.
I was definitely way into soccer. Mm-hmm. Like I remember going to see the Cosmos at the New York I was more interested about going to Giant Stadium to see the Cosmos than to see the Giants.
Right.
One of the cool things about Westchester, you had the very rich, and in the next town over, you had just a cool little working class neighborhood that was very ethnic. There were a lot of first and second and third generation European immigrants.
Yeah.
So soccer was big, and like you'd go to one town, it would be all of the Irish cops that were the cops in the Bronx.
Right.
Would live in this little town.
Yeah.
And then 8 miles away through the hills, you'd get to the country club
right.
town. Being so close to New York City was great.
Yeah.
Because I could go in, you know, go in to see shows, yeah, museums. My mom was way into Broadway plays.
Oh, yeah.
So just being around world-class music and art was a big one.
What did your parents do?
My dad had his own company for a long time. He worked for CBS News for a while.
Cool.
Then he had his own advertising company. My mom was a New York City school teacher for most of her career, most of her life.
So she what do you call it, commuted?
Yeah.
Where they got on a train and went to work every day? Did your dad work in Westchester or in the city?
No, my mom, they both drove.
Okay.
We lived in a town that was very much about the train station.
Okay.
And the train was like, you know, 35 minutes from Grand Central.
Okay.
So most of my friends' parents and most of what me and my friends did on the weekends was going to the city to figure it out.
Right. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have one sister.
Yeah, older?
She's 2 years older than me. Her name
is... Did she get you into music?
Not really. She was much more artistic than I was as a kid. Okay. I was kind of a quiet, shy, kind of math and science geek. And so music for me as a kid was kind of something to get away and just be alone and get into the sound.
Yeah.
Because that made more sense to me than other people.
Yeah. That's interesting because that seems like a bass player's way of getting into music.
Yeah, totally. You know, it was very solitary.
A little more quiet and like, you know.
Yeah.
Not and as like, hey.
Yeah, yeah, I was definitely not.
Like us.
Yeah, I was definitely not the wild front man.
Right.
As a kid playing music.
Right.
But yeah, I had a pretty eclectic tastes. Like I was into I was in a lot of pit orchestras.
Oh, really?
And so like, you know, before I got into classic rock, I got into Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah,
and
that's
then I'm
cool.
Like, oh wait, this guy sang for Deep Purple. What's
right,
Deep Purple?
Right.
And then I'd check out Deep Purple.
Really?
But I started out in pop, and then just the more I got into music, I realized I just love Southern music and the soul of Southern music.
Yeah.
And like, I remember, you know, I remember, wow, most of my favorite records were made in the South, like Memphis or Muscle Shoals or Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When did you first get into like a rock band? How old were you?
When I was 13.
Yeah?
Yeah. When I was in fourth grade, I started on the trumpet.
Uh-huh.
So I was in all the school bands and, you know, jazz and orchestra and stuff.
Right.
And then I got a bass. Actually, it's a kind of a cool story.
Okay.
In eighth grade,
okay,
you had a mandatory choir class. So everyone had to go to choir for an hour or 50 minutes every day.
Yeah.
And then the last 6 weeks or so of school, the teacher was kind of a hippie. Yeah. I didn't really know it at the time or what that meant, but she was kind of like a little freer and goofier in a way than most of the other teachers. And she had gotten like 30 of these cheap nylon string acoustic guitars donated to the school. So the last 6 weeks of school, she would teach us like Kumbaya and John Denver songs and Where Have All the Flowers Gone.
Hippie jams.
Totally. And we're all like trying to, you know, go to C and now to G.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? I believe in music.
Yeah.
I believe in E minor.
Yeah.
Two G's, A7, and D is how she would teach us the songs.
Yeah.
And one day there was this electric bass case sitting in the corner of the room, and I got there early, and I said, "Hey, what is that?" She said, "That's my son's electric bass." I said, "Wow, can I look at it for a second?" And I opened it up, and it was this kind of red wine colored P bass, which I still have it kind of etched in my mind what it looked like, but I had I wouldn't have been able to tell you it was a P bass at the time.
Right.
And I said, "Can I play it for a second?" I took it out and I played it for maybe about 30 seconds before the rest of the class came. And that just blew my mind. I just loved it.
That's awesome.
And then, so my mom took me to Sam Ash in White Plains, New York.
Yeah.
And I got a bass for the next Christmas.
Awesome.
So that was early of my freshman year of high school.
And so that's when you started into bass.
Yeah. And that was really pivotal for me because and then I was into the Police at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember the day I bought that, or the day my mom got me that bass for Christmas, I figured out Walking on the Moon by the police, which is like a four-note little bass part.
Yeah,
but it's a great little melodic. Anyway, I figured that out in the music store, and I was like, oh my God, this is the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
So I had the bass, and I just kind of played at home. I remember learning the Night Court theme, which was one of my favorite sitcoms at the time.
That's a good jam.
Yeah. That was actually Barney Miller.
Oh, yeah.
That came by Night Court was Booty.
A boom, 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 boom,
boom, boom, boom, boom. Yeah, totally. And the Red Hot Chili Peppers were big then.
Yeah.
So I got into slapping early on because of Flea. But I don't really slap much anymore. But
slapping was a big... I was in a funk band around like 89, 90.
And okay, right
there
on.
There was a lot of funk and slapping.
Yeah, that really kind of hit like a wave, which is pretty... In retrospect,
and shorts.
Pretty cool.
They went in hand, like shorts.
Yeah,
and
totally.
This
totally.
Look, maybe shirtless.
Yeah.
Which I was a lot.
Okay, right on.
Were you shirtless?
No, I didn't really do that much.
Okay. So what was your first like rock band?
My first rock band was with some guys from my high school biology class. A friend of mine was cooler than I was. And he's like, "Hey, we have a band and we don't have a bass player. Well, you want to try out?" And so they had me learn...
That never factored into why you ended up playing bass? Because a lot of guys, you know, that play bass that I talked to, they did it because, A, no one played bass. B, they would be hard to get kicked out of a band when you're like the only bass player in your school, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
So, but that never factored in?
No. I got bass because I loved the sound of it and
so
the feel
awesome.
Of it and look of it. And then I would just play at home for hours. Every day I would come home... And just play bass sitting in my, either watching TV and playing, not plugged in,
right?
Or just sit in my bedroom and just play, sit on my bed and play. And so my buddy Alex Heilner asked me to join his band, and they had me learn Birthday by the Beatles. Uh-huh. I forget what Van Halen song, but we had one Van Halen, maybe it was Jump. But I remember how fun and easy going and I was like, I hope they call the Van Halen one first, because I could really do that one well. Like Birthday's really hard because that riff keeps going, the guitar alternates with the vocal, but the bass keeps going the whole way through. So I remember having to like play the riff for a while and like shake out my hand and then play the riff for a while and shake out my hand. And I also didn't realize at the time that I was a friend of theirs, and I was the only bass player in our age group.
Right.
So it's not like they wouldn't have let me in the band.
Right.
But I was really I remember being really stressed about it.
Yeah.
But so that was my first band. We were called Agent Orange.
That's what I was looking for.
Until we realized there was another band called Agent Orange.
I played with Agent Orange. I opened for them. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, on quite a few dates in 2000. It was like late in their career, they did like a re-comeback thing, and for some reason our band...
Oh, that's killer.
Shows in the Northeast with them, yeah. Right, anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, anyway, so we were called Agent Orange for about two gigs, and then someone's older brother or sister must have said, "Hey, you know, there's already an Agent Orange."
Right.
We were Peter, Paul, and Satan
for a while. That is fucking awesome.
Thank you. That was
that is great.
That was my first band name that I made up that I was very proud of.
That is great.
Right on. And I forget what else we were. We had, you know, it was one of those bands where you have a different name every three gigs.
Yeah.
Because no one likes it.
What were you guys playing? You played a Van Halen song. You played Birthday. Obviously, you must have been playing a bunch of birthday parties.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I play it in a band I'm in. I just played it the other night.
Okay. But, no, we had, it was kind of, you know, like as you get more involved in music, like now I can work with guys who pretty much have similar tastes to what I do.
Right.
Like living in a place like Austin or LA, it's like there are so many musicians that you can find people who are like-minded.
Yeah.
But in high school, it's like the keyboard player was a really talented guy who loved Genesis.
Yeah.
So he would say, "Oh, no, we got to do Invisible Touch." And the drummer would say, "Oh, that's so corny. Please." He just wanted to do Stones.
Right.
The drummer already got Charlie Watts, and what was great about him is like, "No, man, the Stones are sexy.
Yeah.
Genesis is geeky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Genesis will not get you chicks." And I remember him saying this. Like, we're all 14.
Yeah.
I used
to say that shit all the time at rehearsals when I was
age. Totally. You can't do that, man. If you want to, you know, he's like, we're doing this to be popular, man.
Yeah.
You can't. No chick's going to want you if you do Abacab. And
no chick wants to have a cab.
Yeah. We had one guitarist who had an older brother who was very cool.
Yeah.
Who was all, like, we were all 14 and 15. And so the older brother was going into the city, and like, through him, I heard about Husker Du and early REM.
Okay.
Like Murmur.
Right.
And Reckoning and U2 before they became a really household name.
Yeah, yeah.
So we would do radio for Europe.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And he turned me on to Fishbone, who became a really big band in terms of combining the funk and eclectic everything. Yeah. Truth and Soul, when that record came out.
Yeah.
That was a big one.
Great album.
So we did a couple songs from that. What else? The singer loved... so we also did Back in the USSR by the Beatles. But we also did Summer of 69. The singer would always want to do, Bob Seger tunes and stuff. So we were kind of this aimless... any classic rock thing that anyone happened to like.
Well, it seems like, you know, back then, radio was working. I remember, you know, like I lived in Houston, there was like a rock station that would play Bob Seger and then play like Hungry Like the Wolf.
Yeah, you know? Totally. Radio maybe wasn't as segment. It wasn't maybe as cool and eclectic as like 70s AM radio.
Right.
But pop music was still rock.
Right.
And new wave was happening. So you would hear Howard Jones as well as Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
Which, I guess...
And Van Halen.
Yeah, totally.
So when you got out of high school, what did you do? Did you go
went to college.
You did? Where'd you go?
Upstate New York, SUNY Binghamton.
Did State you keep University on playing there?
Yeah. I was not a music major. My parents had me kind of convinced that you couldn't really do music for a living. And I remember my dad saying, you're going to be broke and living on our couch. Music is a great extracurricular. So I majored in other things... but I played more music than almost anyone on campus. I was in the big band and the orchestra. I was one of only like maybe three or four people who really got into jazz.
Okay.
So the big band teacher really kind of took to us. We had a little combo. We would do our little version of Oscar Peterson, Miles Davis tunes. Mm-hmm. I was also in a...
So you really just started taking it all in, man. Like,
yeah.
You know.
I had very eclectic tastes.
Yeah.
Pretty early.
That's good.
And I remember I had a great band. I was way into Sly and the Family Stone for a while. Wow. And I remember discovering the Robert Palmer record, Sneak and Sally Through the Alley.
Yeah.
And Little Feet. And then this was also upstate New York as the jam band scene was getting really big.
Like Fish. Fish
was huge.
Right, right.
And the Horde Tour was just beginning.
Yeah.
So like we'd open for Aquarium Rescue Unit.
Right.
And the Spin Doctors
it's Colonel Hampton.
Yeah, Colonel...
Bruce Hampton.
Bruce Hampton, yeah, Colonel something or other.
And sorry, who else?
Anyway, but all those bands would be coming through our college town, so we'd open for a lot of them. We had a lot of these, you know, it was kind of... I was definitely writing some of the tunes. It wasn't songwriting the way I'd consider it now.
Right.
You know, it was kind of excuses to jam and cool chord progressions. Lyrics were kind of irrelevant for me at the time. It was just kind of, you have to throw in lyrics because you need a melody.
Right.
You know.
You need to have lyrics so the girls won't come.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But I was also into ska through Fishbone. And so I had some ska bands that I, there was just this fun buoyancy to ska dancing and music it's just so fun and infectious.
Yeah. It's fun when you're that age, too, because everything's just like a party.
Yeah.
And you figure out, like, wow, I could make my life just one, continuous party.
Yeah, totally.
With my shorts.
Yeah, totally. And then at the end, and then a couple months before the end of college, I just said, if I don't try music, I'll know it was because of fear. I have to give music a shot.
So what'd you do?
I moved to Seattle with my girlfriend. And I
Early 90s?
This was 93.
Yeah, yeah.
So all the grunge bands were already huge, but the city was still kind of...
Yeah, yeah.
It was really percolating with that energy.
Yeah.
I bought an acoustic bass, like within 4 or 5 days there. We got a little, I think it was $450 a month apartment in Capitol Hill, which is the hip little area.
Yeah.
And I just started playing on the street and answering... you know, this is before...
Playing acoustic bass on the street.
Playing acoustic bass. That's I had a couple awesome. Guys. We'd play kind of arty jazz and just kind of groove in front of this bagel shop. The Bagel Stop, actually, that had this great little alcove where we could stand. And then I just started answering, you know, want ads in the Seattle Weekly and stuff like that, and just meeting as many musicians as I could. And, you know, started doing the, you know, the $50 and $75 a night gigs. Mm-hmm. I joined a soul classic, you know, like Blues Brothers style soul review band.
Oh, cool.
Called Cool Ray and the Shades. And all those guys were, they were probably all 35 and 40. And I was 21. They all seemed like ancient to me.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, man, I remember gigging in the 70s and the 80s and da-da-da.
Yeah.
But that's when I really, I was a fan of soul music before that. But then I was like, that's when I really started getting Jamie Jamerson.
Yeah.
And getting more into the subtlety of that kind of music.
Right.
Which I think, and I think that stuff, as a bass player, even though I've, like, you know, we talked about Shooter Jennings before.
Right.
Just before we started recording. Even though a lot of the music I've been doing is more country or roots music, I really bring in this soul element.
Yeah.
Through the bouncy the Jamie feel. Jamerson thing and the yeah. feel, yeah. yeah. And I like when I play with my band's full band, I play bass and sing. I don't play guitar and sing.
Oh, really?
And playing bass, it really helps the band sound a little different. You know, I've been playing bass predominantly for like 30 years now.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm a pretty good guitarist, and so the bass really helps steer the ship.
Right.
You know, and helps yeah. it. No, this is I want it to. This isn't change. Just boom, boom, boom,
right, right.
boom, but it's doom,
yeah.
I can really kind of steer it a little more and let the other guys know what's going on a little more with the bass.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's funny. I haven't talked about this stuff.
That's pretty cool.
At this length in a while. So thank you.
So when did anything huge happen in Seattle, or did you eventually move to LA? What sparked that?
I was in Seattle for maybe 6 years.
Yeah.
And I just remember feeling, wow, I've played with everybody in town.
Uh-huh.
I was not really a fan of grunge. I was much more into the jazzy, bluesy, the jump blues, and like Big Bad Voodoo Daddy and all that stuff. The swing right. revival was happening, so I was doing a lot of those kind of gigs. I was in a cool acid jazz band.
That's cool.
Where I played acoustic bass, but we had, you know, a rapper and a woman who sang and a horn section. It was real, just kind of groove stuff. So short of like starting to hang out with Chris Cornell and all those guys, right. I felt like, wow, man, I've played with everybody in Seattle. There was also a work ethic thing. A lot of the people up there,
slackery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were mellow and they loved music, but they would rather hang out and rehearse and have drinking buddies / band members.
Right. Right.
And I was always like, come on, let's like rehearse and then really nail it at the show. And
yeah.
Let's actually try to get a gig that'll pay something.
Yeah.
I was also it was very important to me to make a living playing music. I didn't want to be a waiter or a barista I had a very talented drummer friend who worked at the Frame store down the street.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I want to play music. And there was this kind of this big chasm between the people who played music for fun and art and the people who did it as a gig.
Right.
And like I was like, no, why should I work at a Frame store so that we can rehearse 4 nights a week, hoping that someone will hear our music beyond our 20 friends who are going to come to the gig?
Right.
When I can learn about Elmore James and Jimmy Reed and play blues on Monday night and actually get paid.
Right.
And then do a honky-tonk gig on Tuesday.
Right.
And then play with my ska band on Wednesday.
Right.
And then we can get together and get our whatever band together.
Yeah.
And a lot of the working musicians kind of looked down on the art guys.
Yeah.
And the art guys who were trying to be in the cool new band really looked down on the gigging guys.
Yeah,
they were like, you're whoring yourself out, yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. How can you do that? And so I was in a couple bands that kind of would come down to San Francisco and L.A., would go down I-5. And I had been to L.A., you know, more than a half dozen times. And I said, L.A.'s a place with so many musicians and so much world-class music, and the big touring acts all find their bands out of L.A. and all this stuff. So I moved down to L.A.
Good.
Knowing with the goal of making a shift, knowing I could make music, but hopefully do it on a bigger level.
Right.
And meet someone like Shooter.
Right. And so what year was that you moved down to L.A.?
That was 2000, I think.
Okay. And then how did you end up, like, it says here you played with Wilson Phillips, too.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Carney Wilson's husband There's a really wonderful and talented guy named Rod Bonfilio, who was, I think, from Philadelphia.
Amazing name.
Yeah. Anyway, so Rob got my number from another bass player, and he had this great kind of pop rock band that had a little bit of kind of Matchbox 20-ness, Wallflowers thing. But he would do Badfinger covers in the set and stuff like that. And so I ended up joining his band, and we would play. This is still when labels had a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so you could get a gig at...
I was actually on a label that year.
Okay, right on.
But
right
they
on.
Didn't have a lot of money.
Okay. But this was a time in L.A. when I would... Like, I made a good chunk of my living getting called by people I didn't really know.
Yeah.
Oh, I got your number from this other guy who was my old bass player or my keyboard player recommended you. I got a gig at Genghis Cohen or The Joint or The Viper Room. And there are probably 15 or 20 of these kind of showcase clubs in L.A. We got a set on Wednesday the 25th from 9 to 9:45. Can I drop by your place and give you a CD of nine songs and then learn them? We're going to do one rehearsal and then the gig. And then they would invite all of their friends and any A&R people or people from labels or whatever that they knew. And then we would do the gig and they would try to forward their career and some would get signed.
Right.
And I made a living for a while just playing with tons of these people. Like every once in a while you get a call 2 months later to actually play the same music again. And Rob was one of these guys. I probably did maybe five or six gigs with him over the course of 6 or 8 months. And he was a good guy.
Say his last name again.
Bonfilio.
God, fuck, that's so good. Yeah. It's almost like Buttafuoco or something. That's such a good name. Like Joey Buttafuoco is like just that Rob Bonfilio.
Rob Bonfilio.
Let's get that guy down here.
Anyway, he's a good guy.
Are they still married?
Yeah. And after, check this out, I didn't know he was Carney Wilson's husband. And he just didn't tell anyone because he was like, he wanted to make music and make it on his own in his own right because of his own music. He didn't want to get any favors because he was, you know, Carney Wilson's
husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so after about 6 or 7 gigs, we're kind of bonding and hanging out more. And he's like, hey, you know, my wife has a band. And they're doing a new record.
And he goes, Wilson. And then,
I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was like, and me and the other, one of the other guys in the band knew, but he had never said anything. Like he understood and was very cool about it. So he was like, yeah, my wife has a band and they kind of have a new record coming out and they're looking for a live band. Would you guys want to do it? And we're like, yeah, who is it? And he said, Wilson Phillips. And I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And he's like, no, I'm married to Carney. You got to come over one of these days. I'm like, whoa. So that was awesome. They did a record that was all like an ode to their parents and that era of L.A. music.
Yeah,
so we did a Jackson Brown tune and a Joni Mitchell tune and, of course, Beach Boys and the Mamas and Papas and Neil Young. And so we all learned the record.
Right.
And then we played The Tonight Show and Good Morning America.
Yeah.
Like, that was the first gig where it was like, they're flying me around the country.
Yeah.
And paying me really well.
Yeah.
And the Ampeg SVT is already there waiting when I arrive.
Yeah, it's fucking cool.
So that was, and I had been in LA maybe 2 or 3 years. So it was like, wow, this is really, that was really exciting. And they were really good people.
Makes the experience a lot better.
Yeah, it was just totally pro.
Yeah.
Wendy.
Yeah, let's talk about her.
Anyway, but Wendy ended... That's creepy. She married the old sound man that they had, and they had been together for 10 years or something like that. It was just a really cool experience.
Nice.
Carney was fucking funny. She's hilarious.
She had a show for a while. I used to watch it.
Oh,
Yeah.
No, she had a ton of personality.
Oprah kind of show.
And she was... is a great musician.
Yeah.
Like, she was the one out of the three women of Wilson Phillips. She was the one, like, when we were rehearsing.
Yeah.
She would say, oh, no, China, that was your note. Because they were kind of relearning songs from years ago.
Yeah.
And
she seems like she's that person.
She has Brian Wilson's mind and understanding of music, I think.
Right.
Like, she could, like, oh, and then in the third bar of the bridge, when you guys do a B minor.
Yeah.
Hey, on the keyboards, can you not do an F sharp on top? Because that's China's note, or that's Wendy's note, and that'll conflict. Like, she could...
That's awesome.
She could pull those little details out of the air.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, she really knows what's going on.
Yeah.
That was just a great experience.
That's awesome. And so who else have you played with? Shooter for years?
Yeah, my main thing was Shooter, and we played for...
5 years?
Yeah, 5, 6 years. 2005 was our first record to 2010.
We did a lot of TV and stuff on that.
We did a bunch of TV. A
lot of touring.
Yeah, we would tour at least half the year. You know, we played Willie Nelson's Picnic 1 year, did the Leno show a few times and Letterman a few times.
Yeah.
We opened for Lynyrd Skynyrd for a while. We opened for Toby Keith and Leon Womack for a while. What else did we do?
How was that? What's a guy like Toby Keith like in real life? Because
I didn't really relate to Toby all that much.
Yeah, they don't get a lot of people like us wanting to hang out with a guy like that.
Yeah.
It's a diplomatic way to say that.
Yeah, he definitely has his thing, and he has... A huge crowd of people that love him and relate to him.
How do they relate? Do they like? Because Shooter seems a little more subversive.
Shooter was a little more subversive.
You know what I mean? Like a little.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. Our goal was kind of to be a little edgier and kind of like the cooler rock and roll cousin of mainstream music.
It's
that
cool.
Was hopefully going to do well.
Right. It's cool that at least you know Toby or Toby's people had the.
They got it.
Wherewithal to be like, yeah, hey, let's have this guy.
Yeah. Totally. The new Toby Keith record at the time had a strong Waylon influence. And I mean, you can hear it in Dierks Bentley and a lot of mainstream country music. Every once in a while, some guy will come out with a song with the Waylon groove that's I'm a badass.
Yeah, yeah.
In whatever form it is. And so he had this record that was real Waylon influenced. And I'm sure he's a lifelong fan of Waylon. And then when we came out, he was like, I want Shooter. So it was, and actually that was really
that's cool.
A gift for us because there were a lot of the mainstream country stations that wouldn't play us.
Right.
But they'd have to say, and opening for Toby Keith this summer at the arena is Shooter Jennings.
Yeah.
So it really helped spread the word. And it was really, it was a great opportunity. One of my avenues into country music was Leon Russell and J.J. Cale.
Yeah.
And there's a whole history of Tulsa music.
Sure.
Tulsa's kind of geographically in the middle. So there are all these great musicians that were very eclectic, that were a big part of rock and roll in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, like the guy that signed Tom Petty and stuff from there.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And a lot of these Tulsa musicians would be guys in Derek and the Dominoes and Delaney and Bonnie and all these big bands. Jesse Ed Davis, Jim Keltner. Like, the list of Tulsa guys just kind of goes
Keltner's
on
Keltner's the Tulsa guy.
Yeah, or the Tulsa area, but he was around that scene before he came to L.A. And then ended up working with a lot of those guys. Yeah, Dwight Twilley's a great one. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And so I was all excited because Toby and all of his band were based out of Oklahoma. So I was all excited to like get cool Tulsa stories about Carl Radel and Chuck Blackwell and all these guys that are on all these records I love. And Toby's bass player, Chuck, was friends with some of them. But Toby had no idea who any of them were.
Of course.
And the rest of the band were guys who were... You know, real talented, but they were not Tulsa guys anymore or Oklahoma City guys. They were just kind of other Nashville musicians and people from around the country. So, you know, but Tulsa loved, I mean, Toby had a relationship with the singers and classic country and could talk your ears off about George Jones and Garth Brooks, but didn't know about some of the guys that I really wanted to hear about. But it was, you know, it was a great tour. You know, you're not going to get along with everyone. One of the things that was really... a lifesaver for me is we would play a lot of gigs with Shooter, and it was a lot of mainstream country people and people who are lifelong fans of Waylon and Jesse Coulter, and real country people who loved Southern Rock or Hank Jr. And I didn't relate to a lot of those people. Like, I'm from New York, and I didn't grow up with a lot of that music. I discovered it later. But then when I started putting my own records out, which started doing well in the Americana world, like KHY and would play me, and KNBT down in New Braunfels. And I started kind of touring on my own on the side with my stuff that was a little more singer-songwriter.
Okay, yeah, I was just about to ask, did you do the trans? You just kind of started doing it.
And then when those people started coming to the shows, I would, like, you know, go to the local radio, the Americana radio station, and do an interview, and I was like, oh my God, these are my people. These are the music nerds, and these are the people who can talk about our influences.
Yeah.
And the people who could talk about, oh man, I remember when Damn the Torpedoes came out. Or man, I saw Doug Somm, da 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 da.
Yeah.
It was when I started putting my own records out and having them do pretty well in the Americana world that I was like, oh, finally some really wonderful, interesting people to talk to
yeah,
on the gig, in between our sets and after the sets, yeah, and stuff like that. And I remember describing, I remember when the John Cusack, is it High Fidelity?
Yeah.
The movie where they're all in the record store. Uh-huh. I was like, the Americana scene is all people like that.
Yeah.
Who just like, we're kind of, no, there are not a lot of us and we're all spread out everywhere. Right. But when we find each other, it's like, oh my God, you like that record too?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And then.
It's like a whole world. I just did, you know, Gerf Morlix?
Oh, he's wonderful.
Just did an interview with him a couple weeks
ago. Oh, right on.
It's really good.
Yeah.
He's but that is that kind of world. A lot of very credible, good musicians, people doing it for the soul of it. So then you put out your first record and you toured around, and it looks like you've got a lot of stuff going on in Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you go there with the last record?
Yes.
Back to the Land.
Yeah, it was actually pretty awesome. We only went to Europe with Shooter once, and it was maybe 2007.
Uh-huh.
Early in 2007, and I had just put out my first record, it was my second record, but the first one I just kind of, you know, sold them out of my trunk and sold them at gigs.
Okay.
But my second record is the one where I, like, the first one where I hired a publicist and a radio promoter. And so that's the first one that really started getting a little bit of a splash. And of course, I'm sure also the fact that I was working with Shooter helps the press kit.
Did you do any opening or anything for him, or did you?
I probably opened a half dozen shows.
That's cool.
And then every once in a while when I would have a new record, I would open up another show.
Right.
I had also been a sideman a lot and a frontman, and I know what it's like. You're like, you know, when you go to when you book your own recording session, and there's another guy who you are hiring to play with you, and all he's doing is asking the engineer questions all day because he wants to get his home studio up and running, and you're like,
I don't like people with their own agenda. You're here.
I thought to make music with me, not to pick the engineer's brain, so that you could get the right gear for your studio next month. And it's like when I'm brought on to help someone else make their music, I really don't want to impose.
Yeah.
Like I really was not like, hey, listen to my new music.
Yeah.
Hey, Shooter, can we do one of my tunes on the record?
Exactly.
Hey, Shooter, I want to open that for you. And it's like when the time comes and when it's right, like I did it a couple times in Knoxville because there's a great radio station, WDVX, that was playing my record a lot. We would do it in Austin and Green Hall, or in New Braunfels, because like, I was like, I will only ask to open for you when I know that people will be coming for me as well.
Right. And
I don't want to milk our relationship and have, I don't want to guilt you into having me be the opening act.
And in those situations, he knows you made a record and you would want to open for him and it would make sense. So it would just be kind of retarded for you to sit there and ask him because he already knows. And if he wants you to, he'll say something.
Yeah.
That's the way I've always kind of handled those situations.
Yeah, totally.
If at all possible.
Yeah, and I just wanted to be as laid back and as classy about it as possible.
Yeah,
you know, and it was good. I'm in retrospect, I'm glad how that part of our relationship worked.
You know,
I never pushed it.
Yeah,
and I don't think I ever really made him uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know what? It's hard with this thing, with this podcast for me, because like about six weeks ago or something, I was out with some friends and Gary Clark Jr. was there. And I know him, but also know that, like, he's in the position right now that when he goes out somewhere in town, everybody's like, dude, can I fucking, hey, dude, Vince, fucking, hey, dude, will you fucking, hey, please, will you? And so, like Jesus with the lepers or something. And so that was a little tough because I wanted to say, like, hey, you want to come over to my house after this time we're hanging out and I could interview you?
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's where I find it hard. Sometimes I do a little pushy stuff.
Well, you need to.
Yeah.
You kind of need to survive to make it.
But the personal agenda thing always drives me nuts.
Yeah.
Like, drives me nuts.
Yeah, you do have to toot your own horn a little bit.
Yeah.
And you do have to be your own booking agent and your own publicist sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, that's just part of the deal. But finding a way to do that subtly and in a way that's you.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I had a situation once, not to go aside, but it'll be fast. Where it was the other way around, where the person had the personal agenda, where it was the producer guy, where I went in and it was a song I did with somebody, or wrote with somebody, and I was going to sing on it or something in the thing. And she was still out there cutting her vocal and stuff. And then as soon as she was cutting like the lead vocal of a song, the dude would turn the shit down and go like, so man, check out these new Avalons I got. And you're just like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, this chick is singing the lead vocal song. You literally just turned it down to impress me with your shit.
Right.
Like, this is the anti-impress.
Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah.
No,
so,
but, yeah.
So, you did some touring then, and you did it for your last tour in Europe. I mean, this is a pretty extensive schedule. This is for next year, right?
Yeah, I'm going to Europe for 3 weeks, January and February. Oh, anyway, the reason I brought going back a little bit, the first time we went to Europe, or the only time we went to Europe with Shooter, probably half the promoters we worked with kind of took me aside and said, I just got your new record, and I love it. And when you want to come to Sweden, call me. I want to give you a gig.
That's great.
And so it's like out of the blue. And I had no idea that doing well on the Americana chart would do anything outside of playing in New Braunfels and Knoxville and Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just give me a little touring leverage when I started to do that more in the States. But a lot of the Europeans would look to that, the playlists of those stations.
Yeah.
To find new cool stuff.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, this is awesome. So the next winter, with Shooter, we would always take like December, January, February off. So I booked a winter tour for a couple weeks, and I went to Sweden, and I think I went to Spain for 4 or 5 gigs.
Yeah.
And so I've been going to Europe twice a year, and I love going over there. They really get it. I think a lot of it in European countries have been surrounded by neighbors that are completely different for a long, long time. And I think once we got into the modern age, which was a little more peaceful,
right,
you know, than like the Habsburgs fighting over land and all
that stuff.
They really respect what's different.
Yeah.
Like, I remember I was in Holland not too long ago, and someone was like, a flamenco artist is coming from southern Spain. We need to go. Like, a Dutch guy getting into flamenco can be pretty great.
Yeah.
But if you want the real deal, you need to import it.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, well, we're going to, and this, oh, and they have all these great Belgian beers. And they're not as, well, I know a lot of Americans who are pretty open to that. Maybe American is pretty like, no, this is a...
Yeah, yeah. But to us, it's more like, hey, you want to have some North Carolina pulled pork? It's more like something like that.
We can do that, exactly.
Colloquial.
Things are very regional and local.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so when someone American comes over, I mean, granted, they still have... Not only will they be into Justin Timberlake or Chris or Justin Bieber and Katy Perry, they also have the local version of the pop artist that does a similar thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? You'll go somewhere and it's like, wow, this sounds just like Pink.
Yeah.
But she's singing in Swedish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But there's definitely a community of people who love this kind of American roots music thing.
Yeah.
And I've kind of been able to tap into, thankfully, this little scene where like, you know, Hayes Carl has played here 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Or the Band of Heathens.
Right.
Have played some of the rooms that I'm playing.
Yeah.
Guy Clark. Ryan Adams. Like, yeah. So it's pretty cool. Like, even though I'm maybe not as big as some of those artists,
the
same community will come out. Like, the promoter might say, this guy's great. Check him out on my website.
Yeah.
Da 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 da. He's going to play in Lauchhammer, Germany.
Yeah.
And then people within a 100-mile radius know that that's the cool venue and that's the promoter you trust for his taste and instinct for music. And then you kind of tap into it.
That's good.
You know, some places I'm playing for 10 people. Some places it's like this wonderful little, concert. You can hear a pin drop and it's 100 people.
Yeah.
So it's been great. I love going to Europe.
That's good.
And also my dad was Dutch.
Okay.
So every time I go to Holland, I'm meeting more of my cousins and second cousins.
Oh, that's very cool.
And learning about like all these little things that I just thought were like I inherited from my dad.
Right.
They're very Dutch traits.
Yeah.
And I was like, cool. Oh my God, I'm like you people want to get to know me because I'm so American.
Right.
And I'm getting into my Dutchness.
That's awesome. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it's great. Great.
I got wooden shoes. I'm smoking weed and I'm sitting under a windmill. What's up?
Yeah. How did this happen? Yeah.
It's beautiful up there too, man. In Holland.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like it.
And I relate to it.
Yeah.
There are so many things that are just part of the culture that I just relate to.
Yeah, they're very, I think they think like people, like artistic Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I read this great book called The Island at the Center of the World, which was about the Dutch coming to Manhattan Island, the Dutch East India Company.
Yeah.
And it was not a Dutch colony. The government didn't care about colonizing. It was just these business people who created this little community on Manhattan and Brooklyn, which was about, you know, 300 or 400 people.
Yeah.
And they would trade with the Native Americans and da da da. They were more worried about trade than anything else. And then the British came in later. Or the British were colonizing some other places. But the British were much more concerned about colonizing and spreading the word of God and having a religious
right.
freedom.
Yeah.
And so they gradually kind of took over New Amsterdam and made it New York.
Right.
But it was interesting. And a whole big thing about this, or well, part of the book was... the Dutch didn't really think about multiculturalism in this positive, accept everyone
right.
way. We're all equal.
Right.
The Dutch were like, if you're good to do business with, if you don't screw me, I won't screw you. I
yeah.
don't care what your skin color is or who you pray to. It doesn't matter. If you're legit, let's work together.
Yeah.
And that's kind of I have that instinct kind of ingrained in me, and I don't
yeah.
you know, whatever. Maybe it's being New York or my dad. My mom was also kind of. Felt that way too, so it was interesting. The more I get into it, the more I'm like, wow, this.
I'm a Dutch
I don't have
guy.
To explain anything to these people.
Yeah,
they get it.
They get me. Yeah, that's yeah. good. That's a good feeling. So, you have your record Night Owl. It comes out on January 22nd,
yeah.
2013.
Yeah,
and you're playing some shows around Texas. I don't know exactly when this is going to come out, but where? And you're going to Europe for 3 weeks. You're really playing like every day.
Yeah,
they got you working.
That's a good. Yeah. That's a good little tour.
Literally, you have no days off.
I have one day that's a fly day.
Okay, well, still.
Which actually, it's unfortunate. I had to cancel I had to reschedule one of the gigs on that list because I found out I'm flying from Lapland in the Arctic Circle.
Okay.
In Finland.
Yeah.
And I have to fly through Helsinki, and I wouldn't be able to get to Holland in time for my gig. So I had to reschedule it.
Oh.
Anyway, whatever. I'm still working as hard as well, that.
You have to reschedule your San Antonio.
Yeah.
How did people find you on the internet? What's your website?
TedRussellCamp.com.
Ted Russell Camp. And it's camp yeah. with a K.
Camp with a K.
Not with the C.
That's right.
We have a mutual friend, Brian Keeling.
Yes, that's
drummer,
what you said you were in.
Yeah, I was in a band with him, Mr. Rocket Baby.
Mr. Rocket Baby.
Real crazy pop band.
That's
cool. We used
cool.
to wear ladies' clothes a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Me and Keeling used to shop at Judy's in the mall and wear tights.
That's awesome.
Anyway, I wish you luck. You're here for like a week or something?
Yeah, here for a week. We played Green Hall the other day. Last night we played the Black Heart.
Yeah.
Very cool place in Austin.
Oh, yeah. I was just there the other night.
Yeah. It's cool. That whole little strip is just all these houses.
Yeah.
Converted into these great clubs, and there's a ton of vibe.
Yeah.
And then, what is
it? Doing Continental Club.
Thursday I'm at the Continental Club. And I'm playing some other... Actually, I'm doing the Roots and Branches thing on KNBT on Tuesday night.
Okay.
So, yeah. It's a good little... I try to come to Texas for a week or two a couple times a year.
Okay.
It's like I'll be back for South by Southwest.
All right.
Doing, I'm sure, a bunch of unofficial South by Southwest shows. And then, go up to
and
Fort
promoting
Worth
your and, record and stuff.
Yeah, that'll be the CD release tour.
Yeah.
So, I'm psyched to come back again in March.
So everyone, look out for Night Owl. Is there anywhere they can preview this?
Actually, you can
preview
you can get it on my website now.
Okay,
I set it up so it's available now,
so
and
just
then
go
it
to
will be available. Like iTunes and Amazon,
yeah.
and
your
everything
other
else.
Stuff's available on iTunes.
Yeah, Amazon. All my stuff is up there already.
Yeah,
so you can search, and it's there. Lone Star Music has also been very good to me.
Oh, good.
So yeah. It's up online.
Well, good. I want to thank Robin Miley for introducing us, hooking this up.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank
middle
you.
Person. And your publicist, Kim?
Kim Grant.
Yeah.
Yeah, she
Tell
does great
I
work.
Tell her I said hi. I don't even know her. We've exchanged some emails, though.
That's what she said when I called Kim and said that, hey, Robin has his friend, Johnny Gowdy, and he's got this great podcast. And
in
Robin's
his apartment.
And, and then she was like, oh, I know him. We're Facebook friends, and I've been hearing about him for a long time. That's
okay.
cool. Like, that's really cool, Ted.
Good.
So yeah.
See, that's good to know.
She
we
had
the
very
Ted
kind...
Russell Camp endorsement.
Yeah.
And the publicist. She from here? Is she L.A.?
She's in L.A.
All right. Well, tell her I said hi. Thank you, Robin. Ted, thank you so much for coming over. I'm glad I got to meet you. And really, thank you, Robin.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very
Whenever
much
Whenever you meet
me.
Anyone and you think they'd be good on the show, let me know.
I'll definitely spread the word.
All right.
Right on.
Ted Thanks. Russell Camp.
Cool.
Right. Ted Russell Camp, man, that guy's really cool. I'm glad that he got to come by. I'm glad that I got to talk to him. Our friend Robin Wiley was here. She was just chilling out. there the whole time. She didn't say much. She might have said something. I want to thank Kim Grant again for having hooking it all up, making sure that it all went down. And thank you for listening. Thanks to Ted. He's a great guy. He's got the record coming out. Everyone go out and get it. I got a copy of it. Night Owl, Ted Russell Camp. All right. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. Don't forget to rate us on there. Write a review if you want to. It'd be nice if you did. We would appreciate it. It helps us get ratings. The ratings on iTunes are judged not just by downloads or plays, but by ratings. And also, there's a formula that they go by. So do that. Subscribe to us on iTunes. And thank you so much. Here's a little more Ted Russell Camp. Bye-bye.
Don't be afraid to fall into my arms and let love do the rest. So baby, fall into my arms and let love do the rest.
It's dreamy weather we're on. You waved your crooked